Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory, which is a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm going to be talking to Rob Ford and Maria Sobolewska, who are both professors of politics at the University of Manchester, about their new book, Brexit Land, Identity, Diversity, and the Reshaping of British Politics. So welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
Hello.
This has the benefits of being a really great book. It's, you know, a really sort of interesting read for anyone interested in contemporary British politics. But it's also a book that it is almost kind of grappling with things that are far beyond the title and the topic. You know, it's really trying to get to grips, I think, with long-term and structural changes that are going on in many societies across the world. And I guess the focus of that, you know, long-term structural change is around people's identities. And this is probably where we can start discussing about the book. And I'm interested in this idea about why you wanted to write a book that was about this idea about identities and why people's identities matter now.
Well, I mean, both of us have worked on aspects of this for a long time. I've worked on immigration politics and the radical right for a long time. Maria's worked on the politics of ethnic minorities for a long time. And the common thread that unites those two things is the exceptional political power of people's group attachments, their sense of identity, their sense of in-groups, groups they consider us, their feelings of threat and hostility towards out-groups, the thems out there. And so we thought that a book that brought those two sides of the coin together would be a great project. And we'd been talking about that for a long time. But then once Brexit happened and all the disruptive aftermath of that as well, we felt that there was a real gap there in terms of understanding how this wasn't just about the EU. It wasn't even just about UKIP or the Conservative Party. It was a story that has its origins and its roots in social changes, rising education levels, rising ethnic diversity, mass immigration that go back literally decades. So we set ourselves the modest task of telling a four-decade-long story to explain how we got the politics we have today.
I mean, I think the book really succeeds in doing that, actually, partially because it has got this, you know, obvious kind of hook of how do we explain just what is going on in contemporary British politics and, you know, and things around Brexit, but also because I think a lot of the social changes that you're trying to describe are now quite familiar topics or territories for contemporary media discussions, certainly for bits of academia. And again, you know, far beyond Britain into European, American, Australian societies. And you sort of touched on them a little bit. But I suppose it's really important to maybe contextualize the individual discussions that go on around particular groups in these longer term changes. So I wonder if you could say a little bit more about like what's been happening with, say, education, what's been happening with changes in Britain's racial diversity, And most importantly, how these things are not even, you know, they're not even across the country, but also they're not even in terms of different generations, different age groups.
So what we describe in our book is actually quite a shocking degree of change that we don't really appreciate, especially in those younger generations. We take them for granted. But even within one lifetime, the people who are now kind of pensioners, they have grown up in a very different country and in a very different society to what our children are now growing up in. And the first change that we describe is this expansion of higher education. But it's not even just the higher education, although we think this is the most significant one. But generally speaking, about only about 10% or less used to go to university. This was an elite kind of future. Very few people would have ever considered this as a thing to do. And nowadays, kids graduating from high schools, in fact, half of them for the very first time last year have gone to university. So it has become the new normal, and certainly for quite a huge number of population. And this change is very important because this is very well documented. The people who do have higher education, especially, but generally that are educated, do have different values, different political values, different social values. And this change on its own, I think, would have already been quite consequential. But what is has been happening that at the same time as our society has become more and more educated, we also saw the rise of diversity. And of course, Britain has always been a diverse country. When you look at the history of Britain, we have a lot of immigration and a lot of cultural mixing. And even when we think about non-white people, there has been a very long history of people from Africa, from India, living in Britain, making Britain their home. However, all of this was on a comparatively tiny scale. And when you think about the 1950s, 60s, 70s, where immigration from what used to be British territories of the Commonwealth, when that starts, this is a really different experience for the British people who were born and bred in England and often would have never seen anyone of a different race, of quite a significantly different religion. So what happens within that one lifetime? We go from a society where it's a unique experience to encounter somebody from a different race, from those very different places in the world, to a society in which almost anybody who lives in a city has a very diverse school that they go to and encounters those people routinely. And even British people who don't live in diverse areas, in fact, they encounter diversity through the media, and mainstream media, for example, has diversified quite immensely, and of course, politics. So we do see that within 50, 60 years, so somebody's single lifetime, we have a completely different society. And that society, of course, looks different, sounds different, and therefore has different values, believes in different things.
I hesitate to say, you know, mechanistically, these social changes in things like education and ethnic and racial diversity have like produced new sets of identity groups in British society. But they do underpin what you describe as the kind of three big blocks that characterize contemporary Britain now, which is essentially two sets of liberal groups and then a conservative group. And again, you know, these map onto things like age and things like geography as well. So I wonder if you could introduce our kind of our stars of the show, as it were, our conviction liberals, necessity liberals, and identity conservatives.
Yes, certainly. And you're quite right. I mean, one has to paint with a broad brush when telling a big story like this one. And these are all, we should emphasize, tendencies, not absolutes. It's not that people get, you know, branded with one of these group identities and that's what they are, then and forevermore. It's more that there are tendencies towards particular sets of attitudes, tendencies towards emphasizing particular kinds of things. And these we can sort of summarize with these kinds of group labels. So to take them each in turn, what we call necessity liberals, that's essentially the term we give for ethnic minority voters. And we call them necessity liberals because they are motivated essentially from group self-interest to align themselves with the liberal part of the majority population, for the very simple and blunt reason that if hostility towards minority groups and outgroups becomes politically mobilized, they are liable to be on the receiving end of that hostility. So they will consistently align with whichever political parties seem to be most consistently opposed to such mobilization, and view with suspicion parties that seek to profit from that mobilization. Alongside them, we have the main liberal group, the sort of identity liberals, conviction liberals, amongst the majority population. And there, I mean, in a line, and we've seen it over the past summer, should emphasize, after we submitted the manuscript of the book, in the Black Lives Matter movement, these are white voters for whom anti-racism and similar social values are really very powerful political motivations, paramount political goals. So these are voters who have not only grown up in a diverse society, but regard embracing that diversity and protecting minorities as central political values. Then on the other side of the coin, you have identity conservatives who tend to be older voters with lower levels of formal education, who are motivated by what we call ethnocentrism. That is a worldview that tends to divide most political problems into issues of us against them, narrowly defined in-groups defending themselves against threatening out-groups. We're talking to you at the moment, Dave, in the early period of October 2020. If you want to see what ethnocentric politics looks like, go and watch some of the adverts for the Donald Trump presidential campaign. It's a sort of absolutely classic ethnocentric political campaign. There is a virtuous us under siege from a series of threatening out-groups. And there's a pretty decent-sized segment of the majority group population that has kind of always thought in those terms. But what rising ethnic diversity and mass immigration have done is provide them with very salient out-groups to mobilize against. So that's the three groups in short. You know, the ethnocentric identity conservatives, the anti-racist identity liberals in the majority group, and then the necessity liberals of ethnic minorities who align themselves with identity liberal white voters because they have a strong group interest in being protected from politically mobilized ethnocentric hostility.
I mean, the question that follows sort of neatly and logically from that, and, you know, it's there in your examples of ethnocentric political campaigning, is how conflicts not emerge, but almost kind of like how conflicts are kind of baked into at least one of these forms of identity, but also perhaps inevitable or unavoidable in the politics between these three groups.
So what we are actually trying to argue with the book is that they are not inevitable, but they are always there, ready to be mobilized by political actors. So our book is kind of half about society in terms of the social change and the attitudes that people have, so the political values and attitudes on certain issues. But the second part of the puzzle is, what do political parties and other political actors do with that underlying, as you say, tension between these groups? So one of the very important things about ethnocentrism that we think is crucial to remember is that it is a very stable tendency. In fact, some people would argue that they are, this kind of tendency is almost innately human. It's what makes us human. We do like to categorize people into groups, into us and them. And a lot of ethnographic research and work has been showing since the previous century and before that ethnocentrism was a tendency behind a lot of human behaviors, like keeping up traditions and kind of group culture. So it is always there, and this conflict does exist, but it can exist at the in a background of politics, if you want. And I think the kind of 90s typical incantation of "it's the economy, stupid" is a good example of how these conflicts can be dormant. They don't have to be mobilized into politics. And so, in fact, the second part of our book is a story of how the politicians ended up making these conflicts salient and mobilizing and capitalizing on them.
Yeah, one analogy I've used in the past in presenting this kind of work is the analogy of forest fires. So some kinds of forest, it's innate to how they grow and the cycles and the climate in which they grow that forest fires will happen. They produce an awful lot of flammable undergrowth, and every so often it burns, and often that burning is part of the natural life cycle of the forest. But the forest isn't on fire most of the time. Things have to spark off the fire. Once it gets going, it can then take on a dynamic of its own, but most of the time the forest won't be on fire. So, you know, there is this also supply side and event-based element to this. It's not inevitable that these conflicts will be mobilized all the time, but the potential for them is always there.
Maria mentioned the kind of, you know, second half of the book, or the maybe we could call it, like, you know, the sort of core case study that the book uses to illustrate this and work out how that spark might happen. And in essence, the middle of the book tells a story of two parts about immigration and immigration policy, and then also, you know, public engagement or public attitudes towards immigration. And we have, I guess, the kind of recent history of immigration, which manifested itself in, I guess, you know, ways we'd maybe be familiar with in terms of outright hostility, in terms of public opinions towards particular kinds of immigration, although not others, an obvious, you know, sort of disconnect or distance between certain parts of the political system and certain parts of the public. And then this changes. And I think that idea of, you know, individuals taking advantage or, you know, making things salient becomes much more important. So I wonder if you could tell me that long story of immigration, maybe first thinking about historically, and then we can turn to a more detailed discussion of the role of immigration maybe in the last kind of 10, 15, 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we really wanted to flag up and highlight in this book, because we think it's really underappreciated, is that the story of immigration politics in Britain runs through two waves, because Britain has experienced two major waves of mass immigration. The first was the post-war Commonwealth wave, and really critically, there was political mobilization against that influx of mass migration that happened within the traditional centre-right Conservative Party. So it's long been observed that the radical right in Britain, at least prior to the last 10 years or so, didn't really take hold in the way that it did in many other countries. And there are lots of different theories about why that may be. We think one really important factor is because the ethnocentric voters who elsewhere in Europe were mobilized against immigration by the radical right had already been mobilized against immigration in Britain by the center right, by the Conservative Party, and by, in particular, Enoch Powell. So Powell made a series of very stark anti-immigration speeches, the kind of language that couldn't actually be used in politics today, which is an illustration of how attitudes are changing, making it very clear to ethnocentric voters that if they were threatened by Commonwealth immigration, then the Conservative Party was the party that was going to exercise control over that threat. That linkage was then reinforced in somewhat more moderate language by Margaret Thatcher, who gave an infamous interview in 1978 in which she said many people are afraid of being swamped by people from different cultures. Again, a classic expression of the ethnocentric worldview, an in-group threatened with swamping by a threatening out-group, even though that doesn't at all line up with the numbers involved. And if you look at the polling data from this period, what you see is that before Powell's interventions begin, ethnocentric voters don't have a clear sense of which party is best place to control immigration. They don't have a preference. From after Powell onwards, all the way through to the coalition era, they have a very clear sense of which party they think is best placed to control immigration, and that party is the Conservative Party. So you have a political alignment, in a sense, between ethnocentric voters and the Conservative Party for decades. And this is also the period when a political alignment builds up between ethnic minority voters, our necessity liberals, and the Labour Party. And for the same reason, because they recognise that if it comes to the crunch, if there's a pressure situation where white voters are feeling threatened by people like them, the Conservative Party will side with the white voters who feel threatened over them. So this alignment was then in place for 40 years before we get to the coalition.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, before we get, I guess, to like literally Brexit land.
The one little aside that I would interject here, actually, because we make a point of this in the book, is that many people object to this narrative of immigration being the trigger point here, as a kind of blaming the immigrants. And this is obviously not what we think at all. But one of the really great examples of why immigration is such a trigger point is actually comes from a very old study from the 1930s of a small town in Oxfordshire called Bunbury, where we had the pleasure of actually living for a year. And when we moved there, we were given this book about Bunbury by a very famous sociologist, Margaret Stacey. And what we found reading this book, that this book is a book about immigration and how immigration threatened the Bunburians in the 1930s and how it really upended their politics in Bunbury. And the one interesting thing about that is that these immigrants in Bunbury were not from abroad. They were from other towns in Oxfordshire and other counties in England. And so this is, I think, an important point to remember when we talk about immigration, whether it is from Commonwealth or later on in during the second wave from the EU, it is not about who the immigrant is. It is not threatening who that might be. It wasn't the fact that they were racially different or ethnically different or spoke a different language. These are not necessary conditions for people to find immigrants threatening. Immigrants are almost a default natural human outgroup. And it is, in fact, really not our position that it was anything to do with the type of immigrants that were coming at all. It is to do with the fact that people who are ethnocentric and find others threatening will always object to immigration, wherever that may be from.
Yeah, and actually there's, I just looked it up as you were talking, there's a point in the middle of the book where you show some historical public opinion data around Irish immigrants as opposed to former or current Commonwealth nation immigrants. And, you know, the way that, you know, these are both categories of immigrant. There's not anything in, you know, sort of the idea of their immigration, but they have these, you know, very, very different responses to, I guess we might characterize British society in the 1960s as maybe being, you know, sort of more driven by identity conservatives or perhaps, you know, more ethnocentric, or am I being sort of slightly unfair to Britain in the 1960s?
No, and this is a big point that we actually make in the book, that the people were more ethnocentric for two big reasons, these social changes that we discussed at the beginning. So when we say that education made people more tolerant, of course, the flip side is that if we lived in a society in which 90% didn't have a university education, that means they were much more exclusionary and they were much more ethnocentric. And similarly, having not experienced diversity, they lived in a society in which diversity was threatening just by deem of just being unfamiliar. And so when we then fast forward to just before Brexit, when we have the most recent kind of data on ethnocentrism levels in the society, we're using the British Social Attitudes from 2013 for this, for example, what we see is that a lot of people in Britain are now extremely tolerant. And even when we talk about this group that we call identity conservatives, they are much more tolerant than their own grandparents would have been.
Yeah, there's a certain paradox here, which is that the identity conflicts are more politicized now, even though society as a whole and all three of our groups are more open, more tolerant than they were in, say, the 1960s and the 1970s. And the resolution of that paradox is simple. It's, as always in electoral politics, follow the numbers. In the end, both the Conservative Party and the Labour Party of the 1960s and 70s had a really strong electoral incentive to deliver policies on things like immigration that were acceptable to identity conservative voters, because that was the overwhelming majority of their electorate. That's no longer the case today. And we've seen many times in the past 10 years that, particularly in the Labour Party, but also in the Conservative Party, the proposition of restrictionist or socially conservative policies on issues like immigration and other identity issues are very contentious. And they're contentious because there's a big and vocal electorate on the other side of that argument now, in a way that wasn't the case in the past.
And this is the section of the electorate that has really transformed not just actually the, you know, electoral underpinnings of the Labour Party, but also actually the Labour Party itself. And I'm really interested in that, because you can tell the story of kind of contemporary politics through changes in the Labour Party, but you also see, I think, a mirror in some ways of what's happened to the contemporary Conservative Party by understanding how Labour's electoral coalition has changed. So what is this relationship between our conviction liberals and Labour?
Well, it really, the big changes start to happen in the 2010s. I mean, it's one of the underappreciated things about the Ed Miliband opposition, is that this is the period when Labour starts to shift decisively in terms of the relative group sizes towards being an identity liberal party, with the majority of its votes coming from university graduates and ethnic minorities. It is important to emphasize that these changes don't, you know, it's not wiping the whiteboard and starting again. These get layered on top of the existing alignments that can be traced back decades in some parts of the country, back almost a century with regards to Labour. But it increases the pressure on those traditional alignments when your activist base, when your new voters, when your safest constituencies, when your MPs are all very consistently on the identity liberal side of this argument. And when your ambitious candidates in seats where the Labour vote is growing are on the identity liberal side of this argument. At the same time, Labour was losing votes already in the coalition years to the identity conservative side of the argument. But in this period, it wasn't primarily to the Conservatives, it was to UKIP. The kinds of voters who ended up in the Conservative column in 2017 and 2019, delivering the now much discussed fall of the Red Wall, they were often going into the UKIP column in 2010 to 15, even though they disliked austerity, even though they wanted greater government intervention in the economy, even though they backed more spending on public services, because what for many of them mattered more was the perceived threat from immigration, was the perceived disconnect between their social values and Labour's social values. So you've got all of these things going on in the coalition. But because Labour's support kind of remains broadly stable in the aggregate, I think a lot of this churn gets missed. It's like if you empty the plug on a hot bath and pour cold water into the top, the temperature can be changing even though the level of water in the bath remains stable the whole time.
I mean, it's a really interesting example, actually, of the way that in some ways the classic kind of territory of politics, electoral behavior, etc., was, you know, dominated by economic questions. And again, Maria, you mentioned the kind of the era of it's the economy, stupid. But really, you know, our Brexit land moment is one about these particular kinds of identity and value-led expressions of electoral behavior. And the way to, you know, sort of crystallize that or think through that is with the referendum. So what is your sort of Brexit land analysis of the referendum over European membership?
So what we focused on particularly in the book is that the referendum offered this binary choice that was not about economy, and it was being led by the this revolt on the right, so the revolt of the people who were threatened by the influx of the other, and however defined and however imagined. And therefore, they kind of gone into the campaign with a force of emotion and identity and a clear argument what this campaign will be about. And so we do see a feeble attempt to reorient this campaign and therefore Brexit towards economy, but it is so feeble. It is actually quite laughable. We actually have found for the book the front page of the Better in Europe campaign that had I think one of the best examples of how feeble it was. It said something like, I think it was Martin Lewis, who said that, you know, having considered all the pros and cons, he's sort of leaning towards staying in Europe. And this was the best quote, the most passionate quote they could have found to make a positive argument to stay in Europe. So the truth is that it was the Leave side that has led in framing Brexit in terms of identity politics. It was always about identity politics for them. And so the Remain side had to accept this tone. And once the referendum has happened, it has woken up. And it has woken up with this newly acquired knowledge that something has happened, that it put them on one side of the fence, and the people on the other side of the fence have won. And so we have gone from a narrative in which we always knew there was something going on the right, on the anti-immigrant front, but we didn't know what the opposite was. We didn't know what was the opposing force. And even just in the campaign, we didn't know what it was because there were so many messy and feeble, as I said, arguments made to Remain. However, on the day of the announcement of the results of the referendum, what emerged is a strong idea what a Remain side was. And it was in opposition to ethnocentrism, to anti-immigration, to this kind of the vision of smaller Europe, a less connected Europe, more inward-looking, Britain, more inward-looking Britain. And so we make this argument in the book that Brexit was a moment of awakening and, in fact, spared on a mobilisation on the other side of the fence.
I mean, I remember very, very clearly the days after the referendum result was announced. I'm sure you do as well, Dave. And my Facebook feed, my Twitter feed filled up with socially liberal, pro-Remain people saying, my country has been hijacked by people whose values I don't share, who are doing things that I regard as threatening and destructive, and I've no idea how to stop it because politics seems to be broken. And I remember replying at the time, and I said, congratulations, guys, you know exactly how UKIP voters think. That's what they've been saying for the past 10 years, more or less. You are now in the same mindset as them. So it really was like, this is the time when this becomes a symmetrical conflict. Before, the running was really being made by ethnocentric voters who already felt threatened in that way. After Brexit, you know, two things. One is the Remain side feels equally threatened and equally motivated to mobilize against the threat. And secondly, these kind of inchoate ideas suddenly acquire a name. You know, now you can't walk down a street without, and if you were to say to a random person in the street, what does leave mean? What does remain mean? They can immediately give you a kind of set of social stereotypes, a group attachment. They know what these tribes mean. And that was another consequence, a very important consequence of the referendum.
And we actually have run some of these survey questions amongst the British population 2 years after the referendum. And what we saw is that they identified very strongly with the new Brexit identities, but also, as Rob said, agreed what it meant to be a Remain person or a Leaver person. And even though there was this clear division in how positively these two groups were evaluated from the other side of the fence, right? So the Remain people were accusing Leavers of all sorts of nasty things, etc., and the other way around. But asked, for example, were the Leavers older and were the Remainers younger? Everybody was on the same page. So this is becoming, from a fleeting campaign slogan, this is becoming part of a fabric of our society, our political and social identities.
I mean, obviously that, you know, raises the question of, so what's likely to happen? There's loads of things that we could have talked about in the book. You talk about Scotland independence referendum. There's stuff about the two general elections of 17 and 19. There's a much more detailed engagement with the recent history of immigration. But I think the question that really stands out from the almost, I guess, kind of, you know, playing field of British politics that we confront with these quite fixed and quite intuitively, you know, kind of understandable identities is what's going to happen. You know, are we going to see a sort of further, you know, kind of collapse of particular political parties and the rise of new ones? Could we ever go back to, you know, the kind of pre-Brexit land identities, or will things just get kind of, you know, more messy, more fragmented? What do you think?
I mean, possibly disappointingly for people who've just written a 400-page book on this, I think my initial answer would be, I don't know for sure. I mean, it's difficult to know for sure because history tells us that could it be possible that these identities that have become so ramped up and intensified demobilize again because those feelings of threat dissipate and other issues sort of arrive on the agenda? Yes, that's happened before. Is it possible that these identities, once ramped up and mobilized symmetrically, polarized politics for many years to come and new issues end up being seen through the lens of these tribal alignments that have now formed? Yes, that's happened before too. So the truth is, we don't really know yet how it's going to play out. It's quite possible that politics goes back to the traditional bread and butter economic issues. Maybe COVID accelerates that. Alternatively, it's quite possible that everything becomes a bit of a tribal conflict. Everything becomes a bit of a culture war because voters, in trying to explain new issues, reach to these new identities that are now so chronically present for them.
You shouldn't have said voters. We always say that people. It is down to politicians, really,
yeah,
to
that's the other
thing, cast yeah. these conflicts into politics or, well, I can't really say cast them out, but in a sense, that is the temptation, and especially for politicians who are used to relying on ethnocentric voters and have had some success in winning them over, I think it will always be very tempting to try to get a quick win because these issues are so emotive and they are about a survival for a truly ethnocentric voter. I honestly think that this instinct to be threatened by others is about survival. They really believe that their culture won't survive, that their way of living will not survive. And if there was a political option, and especially if that political option is a big political party like the Conservatives, who are of course now in government and actually have power to change policy right now, I think that is going to be dangerous. So if the mainstream politics moves on to economy, again, if COVID pandemic especially causes a major long-term recession, for example, that's likely. But if there are around politicians who want that conflict fueled, it will burn. That's my prediction.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is that politicians do have to bear some of the responsibility for their choices on that as well. We're very strong believers that it's not just the case that politicians like have no choice but to respond to these phenomena. They help to shape these phenomena. What voters understand as being us or being them is partly shaped by how politicians frame these things. Whether people see particular issues as us versus them issues is partly down to the cues they get from politicians they trust about what an issue is about. So partly the answer to this question will depend on the choices that politicians make. And the problem is that particularly on the conservative side at the moment, there is the standing temptation now to reach for the kind of ethnocentrism panic button.
Is this something that you think is sort of playing out in lots of other places? I mean, again, you know, intuitively, if you look at how much of the Republican campaign is going in the US presidential election, there are examples of various, I guess, you know, groups on the right in European countries. You know, we'd say, oh yeah, you know, this is, we can really see these kind of identity conservatives, and, you know, maybe link it directly to these social changes, particularly around education. Or that they're things that are kind of like, you know, unique and weird to Britain that that make you say we should be sort of slightly cautious about applying this analysis elsewhere.
So we do mention a lot of parallels with elsewhere in the book, and it's not just to do with education, which is a trend everywhere, in the kinds of politicians that we get. Also, there has been an international trend that we see everywhere. But we do have to remember that Europe is very different, mostly because in the most European countries, we do see proportional representation and therefore multi-party systems. And therefore, in the vast majority of European countries, now we have seen a bit of a retreat, in fact, of the radical right. And we certainly see a fluctuation of all these political options to a greater extent than in America. There is a system that's polarized by design, by the fact that we have only those two parties. If the parties start polarizing and making differences between each other based on those identity issues, it is much harder to overcome that problem. And this is, I think, a warning sign for Britain, because Britain, of course, has a very similar system. And it's not quite as starkly two-party as in America, but there certainly is this risk that it will get baked in, those identity conflicts, into the two parties. And in fact, as we have discussed in the book, it has happened to an extent in 1960s, and it can happen again, that one of the parties will become forever the party of the identity conservatives, and the other party will be the identity liberal party. And this, in fact, is a way to perpetuate that identity politics dynamic, because every time there will be an election, instead of arguing about economy and other issues of policy, we will be arguing again about what is the main difference between the two parties, and that thing might be identity politics.
And I mean, the US during the Trump presidency, it provides like an amazing case study of what unfolds if an identity division between ethnocentric and identity liberal voters becomes entirely primary. I mean, identity politics, racial politics, has always been central to US electoral politics for as long as the Republic has existed in one form or another. But under Trump, it really has escalated. I mean, the Republican Party are the ethnocentric party. Trump's every pronouncement is infused with ethnocentrism. Fear and hostility towards immigrants, towards Latinos, towards Muslims, towards various countries in the world, towards women, towards anti-racist campaigners, all of it. The constant theme of Trump is there are all these groups who want to sow chaos and disorder, and only I stand in the way of it and will protect you, my in-group. I mean, that's the quintessential ethnocentrism. And Trump, in his election in 2016, was able to win over traditional, economically left-wing, working-class Democrats to form a just-about-winning coalition. However, within 2 years of doing that, the Republicans were losing wealthier, highly educated white graduates in the suburbs hand over fist in state over after state. It cost them the House of Representatives. It cost them a number of Senate races. It looks set to do so again. So you have the mobilization around ethnocentrism, and then you have the counter mobilization of voters alienated by that ethnocentrism. And that is the risk when you take an identity division like this and move from it being one amongst the number of things that influences voters to becoming the single big decisive thing that aligns voters. Because there are plenty of wealthy suburban Republicans who have a number of reasons to prefer the Republican Party in terms of their economic interests. But they are not voting that way at the moment because the election is chronically about this identity conflict for them. And in the darkest timeline, I guess, in Britain, we would see a similar kind of unfolding here to a situation where really the questions of ethnocentrist or identity liberal become central to how everybody votes. In a rather different way, and I don't think it's just about ethnocentrism, but it is about an identity question. That's how Scottish politics has ended up at the moment. Right now, the question of independence or union just completely dominates everything else in Scottish politics. And as a result, voters with very different interests and views on a number of other issues, including many of the central economic questions, are lining up for or against independence and basically going SNP or increasingly going Conservative on the unionist side. So it's not just the initial mobilization of ethnocentrism that can produce a big disruptive effect. There's further waves of counter-mobilization that can happen. And politicians who want to amp up ethnocentrism, that is the risk they run.